Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Turning now to one of Australia's finest legal minds, Julian Burnside QC has become Advocate-in-Chief, unofficially, for asylum seekers looking for a safe harbour in Australia. His passionate defence for human rights saw him conferred with the Order of Australia in 2009, and his pro bono work for those who can't afford to pursue legal options has him crisscrossing Australia at a breakneck pace when not rising in court. So, we're very grateful he's found time to join us on Open House this afternoon. Julian Burnside, thank you so much for the chat. Let's start with asylum seekers. What are Australia's legal obligations to someone seeking asylum in this country?
Well, I guess the first obligation is not to harm people. We do have general obligations under the Refugees Convention, which is that if people come here seeking asylum, we cannot return them to a place where they might be persecuted. That carries with it an obligation to find out whether they are refugees as a matter of fact. So we're obliged to process them. Beyond that, we have obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Child not to mistreat children. We have obligations under the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights not to arbitrarily detain people, not to torture them, and so on. All of those obligations and more are probably breached by some aspects of our treatment of boat people.
Julian, the UNHCR has condemned the Australian government for the way we're treating asylum seekers, but what other legal avenues are there for them to have us change our policy?
None. The fact is the UNHCR and the UN Human Rights Committee are effectively powerless to do anything to correct our behaviour. You would hope that sort of condemnation might operate on the conscience of the country to improve our performance, but so far that didn't seem to happen. Interestingly, there have been several decisions of the UN Human Rights Committee which have said that our ordinary detention system of refugees in Australia breaches Article 9 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights as constituting arbitrary detention. So just, you know, plain vanilla immigration detention is a breach of our human rights obligations. And whenever the Human Rights Committee makes a decision like that in particular cases and passes it on to Australia, Australia says, oh, yeah, thanks very much, see you later. I think the real question underneath this, though, is what sort of country do we think we are? You know, there's a growing disparity between the way we see ourselves and the way other countries see us. You know, we see ourselves as friendly, generous, welcoming, bronzed Aussie diggers sort of thing, whereas the rest of the world is increasingly seeing us as rich, selfish and cruel.
Added to that perception of ourselves, Julian, you believe that if more of us knew more about what's going on inside places like Manus Island and Nauru, we'd be less affirming of the government's position to send people there.
Possibly so, but I think there's another element in this that needs to be taken account of. This was well illustrated recently by someone who I spoke to. He said, look, let's suppose you come home one day and you find your front door open. You walk down the hall and you find a stranger in the kitchen and the cookie jar is broken on the floor, okay, and the stranger has got a cut hand. And you say, what the hell are you doing in my house? You know, anyone would say that.
Yeah.
Now, here's two ways it might play out. One is, he says, well, you know, I was feeling a bit hungry and I saw your doors open, so I just thought I'd come in and steal some food. I've cut my hand, do you mind getting me a Band-Aid? Well, most people would say, well, you know, fair go.
Yes. Yeah. That's a bit presumptive.
Yeah, take a jump.
Yeah.
And frankly, I would agree with that response. On the other hand, let's suppose the person says, look, I'm terribly sorry, I'm actually a diabetic. I didn't have my EpiPen. I could feel myself going into a diabetic coma. I saw your door was open. I came in and called out, hoping I'd find someone. Couldn't find anyone, went to the kitchen thinking there might be a bowl of sugar, couldn't find that, reached for the cookie jar, but I was still already trembling, and I knocked it over and broke it. I'm very sorry about that. I managed to eat one biscuit, and I'm feeling a little bit better, and I've cut my hand. Have you got a Band-Aid? Now, most people then would say, oh, yes, look, is there anything else I can do to help? You know, your response in identical circumstances will be greatly different depending on what you think that person is. Now, what the Australian government has done, and they've done it pretty effectively since 2001, is persuade the public that boat people are criminals, they're people against whom we need to be protected, they're people who are in some way, you know, not our kind of people, morally oblique, dangerous to us, etc., and we need to be protected from them. Now, if they were, in fact, dangerous criminals, and if we did need to be protected from them, I would support what the government is doing. But they're not. More than 90% of them, on assessment, turn out to be fair income refugees, legally entitled to our protection, and most of them are very frightened people who are brave enough to risk their lives at sea trying to escape persecution. Now, you know, you respond differently depending on which version of the facts you accept.
Yeah.
And the rhetoric, is in, especially in the last 12 or 18 months, about illegals, quote unquote, I think has caused immense damage to the public response, because I think by and large Australians are decent people. And if only they knew that we are mistreating innocent people, who aren't a threat to us, I think most Australians would think, oh, Bali, that's a bit hot. And that's why children in detention is such a hot button. Because, you know, I mean, you look at a four-year-old behind razor wire and you say, well, hang on, what's that kid done wrong?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
But playing devil's advocate for a moment, Julian, what about the 10% that aren't innocent?
Well, then you have to say to yourself, are we a country which is willing to punish the 90% in order to deal with the 10%? Now, collective punishment is generally regarded as a pretty bad thing. And interestingly, we don't have the same reaction to people who come here by aeroplane seeking asylum. More people come into Australia by aeroplane seeking asylum than come in by boat. They're the lucky ones who can actually get a travel document and a visa.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they come into Australia with a short-term visa for tourism, business, study, something like that. And when they clear immigration control, they apply for a protection visa. When their first visa runs out, typically after a few months, they get a bridging visa, which allows them to stay in the community until their refugee status is finally decided. And that can take years. Now, less than 50% of them succeed in establishing a claim for protection. So the ones who are least likely to be refugees are allowed to stay in the community and doesn't cause any trouble. The ones who are most likely to be refugees get locked up and mistreated.
Julian, given that the Australian government now, and others before it, in fairness, have chosen to take a very offensive position against the marauding hordes, pushing them back, or at the very least protecting our borders, quote-unquote, are you more hopeful that change when it comes to asylum seekers will develop out of the Manus Island inquiry, which has just kicked off?
Yes, I'm cautiously optimistic that something might come out of that that might change public attitudes here, but frankly, I think a lot of Australians don't mind it if asylum seekers get beaten up on Manus Island, because they have the view that these are dangerous criminals. You know, it all comes back to the way you see the person you're thinking about.
Yeah.
And I think it's very alarming to reflect on last year's election and to remember that it is the only election in Australia's political history where both major parties have tried to win votes by out-promising each other on their cruelty to other human beings. It's no accident that the Department of Immigration and Citizenship has now been renamed the Department of Immigration and Border Protection.
Yeah.
Now, you know, what are we protecting ourselves against? Jesus, I mean, these people are doing nothing worse than asking our help to protect them against extremists in their own countries.
Julian, what are the legal avenues for somebody sent automatically to Manus Island or Nauru? What rights do they have right now?
The Australian government's official position is that we've got nothing to do with those detention centres. Notwithstanding, we build them, we stock them.
We run them.
We guard them, we run them, yeah. All of that. But, you know, when it comes to legal proceedings, the Australian government says, what? Oh, I've never heard of that. Yeah. Well, what's going on there? You know, they just completely deny any involvement at all.
But the government puts the tender out for these centres to be run. They appoint the people to actually run these centres.
Yeah, you don't have to persuade me. You're exactly right. I mean, it is breathtaking. The hypocrisy that underlies all of this is amazing. And by the way, all of this, you know, the dog whistle that carries all of this is these are dangerous criminals and we're doing a good thing by protecting you. But on the surface, what they say is we've stopped people from drowning at sea. Now, I do not for an instant believe that any of the politicians who say that are actually sincere about their concern of people drowning at sea. Because if you want to, if you are really serious about stopping people drowning at sea, what you'd do is set up a fair income processing centre in Indonesia and offer them swift, safe resettlement if they're assessed as refugees. Mm. You know, that's the way you stop people getting on boats.
Yeah.
The fact that people get on boats is a measure of their desperation to escape persecution. People don't risk their lives just for the hell of it. They don't risk their lives as a lifestyle choice. They risk their lives travelling from Indonesia to Australia because they want to reach safety.
Julian, I understand that as the poster child, for the want of a better term, for asylum seekers' rights, you receive a heap of mail every day and much of it isn't pretty. The ugliest of it, you respond to individually. You reply to those letter writers. What's the thinking behind that? Are you trying to bring them around, develop their understanding of the debate?
Yes, I have had a lot of hate mail, and I get abused on Twitter and so on. And I get death threats, which is kind of interesting, you know, when you're sort of defending people without any payment.
Yeah.
I get a lot of hate mail, and I always try to answer it. If it's not just abuse, I try to answer it because I figure these are people who obviously disagree with me, and if they knew the facts, maybe they might agree with me.
Are you aware of people changing a position based on your correspondence?
Yeah. I would say, I haven't done the detailed numbers, but my general impression is about 50% or more of the people who write abusing me ultimately change their opinion, and they tell me they've changed their opinion, after an exchange of typically two or three emails back and forward.
You're very generous with your time on many other requests as well, even those not even seeking legal advice, just on a relationship basis based on your profile. What are those people looking for more often than not?
It's a bit difficult to generalise, but I guess because I've got a profile as doing pro bono human rights work, I get a lot of people contacting me asking for help with, you know, their human rights problem, but often it's not a human rights problem at all. Often it's not even a legal problem, but I think it's only decent to respond to people like that and to take their concerns seriously. And it's quite interesting, you know, I've had a number of people who write in, and it's very clear that if they had a legal problem, it's statute barred decades ago, and there's really nothing that can be done. But by writing back to them and explaining why it's no longer possible to do anything as a matter of law and that they should try and put it behind, it's surprising how many people feel better for that. Because I think there's a lot of people in the community who are living fairly unhappy lives and who are accustomed to being ignored. And the more they're ignored, the more they shout, and the more they shout, the more people ignore them. And so they end up ringing late-night talkback radio or writing to me.
Julian, do you remember that moment where you developed that fire for representing the rights of asylum seekers, or was it an accumulation of cases and you observing the news cycle and deciding to step into the fray?
There was a moment. In the wake of the Tampa litigation, I found myself being asked to do lots of pro bono cases. One of the early ones I was given was involved an Iranian family, mum and dad and two daughters who were, I think, 10 and 7 at the relevant time. They had fled Iran in really very bad circumstances, and they were banged up in Woomera for about 15 months. And at the end of the 15 months, they were all doing it really hard, but especially the 10-year-old who'd really given up. And, you know, she'd stopped eating, she'd stopped caring for herself, she wouldn't brush her hair, wouldn't brush her teeth, didn't care about her clothes. She was scared to go to the toilet block, so she would wet the bed at night and wet her clothes during the day.
Yeah.
And she was in a really seriously bad way. Well, a psychiatrist in Adelaide heard about this and went to Woomera and delivered a report to the department saying, this kid is at grave risk. You really need to move the family to a metropolitan detention centre where she can get daily clinical help. Because in Woomera, people with genuine psychiatric needs would be lucky to see a psychiatrist once in every 6 months. So she needed daily help. Anyway, the department didn't do anything, so the psychiatrist wrote another report a few weeks later, and eventually the department relented and sent them to Maribyrnong in the western suburbs of Melbourne. For the first 2 weeks of their stay, even though the reason for sending them there was that this kid needed daily clinical help, for the first 2 weeks of their stay, no one came to see her. And on a Sunday night in May of 2002, while her mum and dad and her young sister were in the mess hall having dinner, this little kid took a bedsheet and hanged herself. But she didn't know how to tie the knot properly, so she's still suffocating when they come back from dinner. Goodness. And she and her mother are taken to the general hospital nearby. She's put in intensive care. Two ACM guards at the door of the intensive care unit, so that legally they're still in immigration detention. And Con Karapanagiotidis, who had recently set up the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre, he'd been looking after their things, and he heard about this. He went to the hospital 9:30 at night, Sunday, and said good day to the guards, you know him well, because he's a regular visitor at Maribyrnong. He said, I just want to speak to the mother to see if there's anything I can do. And they said, no, you're not allowed to see them because lawyers' visiting hours in immigration detention are 9 to 5, and they sent him away. And then he rang me at home that night and told me what had gone on. That is the moment when I caught fire. That's the reason I will never give up on this fight, because I think it is criminal that our system can drive a child to try and kill herself and then turn away simple human help.
What can we do, Julian Burnside? It's a government making a decision, and yes, there are elected representatives, and a great many of us have been blindsided by the language that has inculcated this argument. What can we do today to redress this humanitarian travesty?
I think the main thing now is for people to be reminded that these are not criminals, they're not dangerous, we don't need to be protected from them, they're human beings in distress, and we should react in the way that Australia is famous for. We should react with some sense of compassion, some sense of understanding, and let's face it, we can actually benefit. We can actually benefit from their presence in the country. These are the people who've got enough initiative and enough courage to risk their lives at sea. You know, and now a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, they're not at risk in Indonesia. That's not true. Indonesia hasn't signed the Refugees Convention. If they're found in Indonesia, they can be sent back to the country they've fled. If they're found in Indonesia, they can be thrown in jail. Now, you know, they can go around the corner to the UNHCR office and get assessed as refugees, but that doesn't get them protection. What it means is they have to hang around 10, 15, 20 years until some country offers to resettle them safely. Now, you know, in the meantime, they can't work, can't send their kids to school. So imagine you're in their shoes. Imagine you're fleeing the Taliban or the Rajapaksa regime, and you're in Indonesia, and you've got a ticket from the UNHCR says you're a refugee, and you're hiding in the shadows because you don't want to be sent to jail, but you've got a chance of safety. You can either waste 20 years of your life and watch your kids grow up without schooling, or you can jump on a boat with all the risk that that carries. What would you do? I've never met any Australian who'd do anything different from what the boat people do. And yet we use the fact that they got on a boat, we use that as a reason for punishing them.
Julian Burnside, thank you for your advocacy, and thank you for your time this afternoon.
Good on you, thanks.